Chapter 3. When the Diane ran onto her uncharted reef, she was carrying the British envoy to the Sultan of Pula Prabang back to Batavia, the first stage in his journey home. Mr. Fox had been successful in negotiating a treaty of friendship with the Sultan in spite of active French competition. And since he was extremely eager to carry it to London, he and most of his suite set out in the frigate's pinnace with an officer and crew to sail the remaining 200 miles in what appeared to be favourable weather. At the same time, he left a fully authenticated, signed and sealed duplicate with his private secretary, David Edwards, both as a reasonable precaution and as a means of getting rid of him. Mr. Fox had taken against the young man and didn't wish for his company during the long voyage from Batavia to England. But the pinnace had been overtaken by the same typhoon that shattered the grounded Diane. And with the envoy and the original lost, this duplicate took on an entirely different importance, and the penniless, cheerful, sanguine young man, much in need of some settled employment, built great hopes upon it. If he were to appear in Whitehall and say to the minister, "Here, sir, is the treaty with the Sultan of Prabang," or, "Sir, I have the honour of bringing you the treaty concluded between His Majesty and the Sultan of Prabang," surely it must lead to something. Not indeed to the knighthood or baronetcy that Fox had expected, but surely to some little place under government, attaché in one of the smaller, more remote legations, or deputy harbinger to the Board of Green Cloth. He was an honourable creature, and he had no knowledge of the poisonous letter that Fox had enclosed with the duplicate, a letter that spoke ill of practically everyone aboard the Diane, particularly his secretary. But Stephen, who as an intelligence agent was obliged to live by a different code, was well acquainted with its contents. Edwards, bound by duty, a lingering affection for his chief, decent interest and everything that was proper, had enveloped the treaty in linen, waxed silk and an outer case. He always carried it in his bosom, and now, as he and Stephen stood side by side on the lofty poop of Lipo's junk, gazing astern, he tapped his chest, which gave out an answering, hollow, cardboardy sound, and said, "Sometimes it appears to me that this document is under a curse. It's been wrecked and very nearly sunk. It's been attacked by Dyaks and very nearly burnt. And now it's in grave danger of being seized by pirates to the utter annihilation of all our efforts." "Sure, this is a sight calculated to freeze a man's blood in his veins," replied Stephen, looking at the wicked proa tearing along in their wake, close hauled to the southwest breeze, both its outriggers skimming white on the sea. Wicked in that it was certainly a pirate and much faster than the junk, but not very dangerous in that it was small, containing no more than 50 men squeezed tight and possessing not a single gun. "Yet even so, I think they will sheer away, as Captain Aubrey would put it, as soon as he and Mr. Welby have ranged the marines along the side. In any event, my Mayu has more experience of sea dyaks and of pirates in general than any 12 of us assures me that this is only a low Karimata proa. She wonders at its assurance, since this is Wanda's territory. When he is neither hunting nor on duty at the palace, he sails up and down the strait and to and fro in it, levying tribute on all those who have accepted his protection, and sinking or burdening the rest. At last the marines came clumping up, redcoats, white crossbelts, bright muskets and all, fit for any parade ground. They lined the rail, all the rails, and Captain Aubrey called up to Stephen, "Pray tell him to port his helm." A series of barking falsetto orders in Chinese, and the junk began a smooth curve that displayed her overwhelming armament, which included the two carronades. The pirates, having contemplated this for a while, turned and went racing away to the northwards in search of an easier prey. "Mr. Welby," said Jack, It might save many valuable lives, was you, to dismiss your jollies at once and let them take off their stocks. With Li Po he exchanged smiles and bows, and to Stephen and Edwards he said, "I'm so sorry to have kept you in fear and trembling all this while, but the construction of the junk is so very unlike anything we're used to that the poor fellows couldn't come at their things. Boots in one hold, accoutrements in another, bayonets far from crossbelts, and pipe clay in the after magazine with the gunpowder. Would you believe me, gentlemen, if I were to tell you that this vessel has no less than 6 separate holds? And when I say separate, I mean divided from one another by a watertight bulkhead." His officers came swarming up a ladder to a curious little deck or platform without a name in the Royal Navy vocabulary, looking about them with the lost amazement usual in landsmen aboard a man of war. "Ain't I right, Mr. Fielding?" he called. "When I tell the doctor here there are no less than 6 separate holds." "It's an understatement, sir," replied Fielding. "Richardson and I make 7, and the master reckons 8. We're going to make another tour. The midshipmen say they've reached double figures."
My sweet girl," said Stephen down through a grating beneath which the little girls could be seen playing an elaborate form of hopscotch, "would you be a kind child and show these gentlemen each several compartment of the junk in turn? I'm sure they'll give you a whole ship's biscuit for yourself."
Ship's biscuit. They were passionately attached to it, old though it might be, and couldn't be brought to believe that in ordinary times the seamen were given a pound every single ordinary working day. "It is a strange way of building a ship," said Jack, "but, Lord, it has its advantages. If the Diane had had those bulkheads, she'd be swimming yet." And he went on about the wonderful economy of knees, the flexible strength far surpassing even what seppings could provide, until the vacant expressions before him quenched his flow. "I must dress that boy's leg," said Stephen. "On the right there stood another pelican." He had not only the splints to attend to under the anxious parent's eye and the startling purple balm to renew, but also his serious rans in company with Macmillan, who he found to his surprise was drunk. Some degree of drunkenness was a common state aboard a man of war after dinner, and here the degree was more pronounced than usual, the grog having been mixed with Li Po's arak, a spirit almost twice as strong as that saved from the Diane after the purser had stretched it with pure rainwater and a little vitriol. And Macmillan had, of course, dined in the midshipman's berth at noon. For all that, Stephen was surprised, Macmillan being ordinarily a most exact, abstemious man. Even now he was perfectly steady, and his dressings were perfectly neat, but his more or less neutral English was invaded by his native Scotch with its curious glottal stops, strong aspirates and rolling R's, and his general attitude was more assured and loquacious than usual.
"I lay awake the nicht," he observed, "and on the sudden it came to me why you'd crack at yon wee bairn's leg. You must have thought me a poor, slow-witted gowk."
"Not at all," said Stephen. "There is a nevis on his shank that we might do well to cauterize against future trouble. Did you remark it?"
"Aye, that I did. My wife had the very same bit abin the knee."
They were in the relative privacy of the space that served both as captain's storeroom and as dispensary. And Stephen, who had a real esteem and even affection for his assistant, felt required to say, "I was not aware you were a married man, Mr. Macmillan." For some while, Macmillan didn't reply, being occupied with putting their pills, plaster, draughts and bandages away with his usual obsessive neatness. But when he did speak, it was as though he had already made a comprehensive answer, his present words being a continuation.
"I had thought your wife was a person a man could tell his dreams to, but then one day she flung the collops in my face straight from the skillet, cried the hell with your fork at dreamings, whipped out to the door and locked it fast behind her."
He closed the medicine chest, making the same movement with the key, and said, "I never saw her more." They lived at the very top of a lofty house in Canongate, he added in parenthesis, before going on in a different voice. "But I never was a good husband to a canty young woman like her. Even as a boy I had dreams of tall candles bending over in the sunlight down to touch the shelf. And when I was a man it was much the same. I would be there pointing a pistol with a certain triumph, you understand, and the barrel would droop, droop." Some decks away, some holds away, Stephen heard the drum beat Roast Beef of Old England for the officer's dinner. "You must forgive me, Mr. Macmillan," he said. "The captain is so particular about punctuality." The roast beef that day consisted of the remains of the babaroosa, some cooked in the English, some in the Chinese way, a variety of little Javanese dishes, and then the best bird's nest soup that any man much under the rank of emperor was ever likely to see before him. "I think, gentlemen," said the captain, 2 minutes after they'd drunk the king's health, "that we're coming up into the wind. Doctor, would you let your Ahmed jump up on deck and see what's afoot?" Ahmed came back in a moment, and bowing, he said in a conciliatory, deprecating tone that they were stopping, loosening the sails to let a pirate come up, a pirate twice the size of the junk. Li Po had told him that flight was neither possible nor desirable, nothing more fatal. "This is out of the frying pan into the fire," said Edwards to Stephen, as they stood on coils of rope immediately behind Jack and his officers, gazing at the uncommonly large war proa immediately to windward, and the canoe that was paddling towards them. "If you please, sir," said Reed in a low voice, "may I share your coil?" "Of course you may, Mr. Reed," said Stephen. "Take my hand, and for God's sake take care of your stump against the wooden thing here. To see so perfect a union damage would break my heart." And returning to the secretary, he went on, "A very striking figure, Mr. Edwards, but not, if you'll forgive me, quite accurate. Gridiron would be nearer the mark, since Malays always grill their Christian prisoners. Those, that is to say, whom they do not crucify. You may read of this at length in the Père Duhalde." "I shouldn't feel nearly so strong an inclination to apostatize if it were not for this treaty," said Edwards. The canoe came alongside. Its chief and two lieutenants were handed in at the junk's version of an entering port, where Li Po and his mates received them with deep reverential bows. At Li Po's first words, the chief stared about with astonishment at the English seamen, the marines, now in old shirts and trousers, the officers, and finally, Stephen. At this, his face changed to candid delight, and he hurried over, his hand held out in the European fashion. "Wanda, my dear, how do you do?" asked Stephen. "You recognise Captain Aubrey, I'm sure, and his valuable officers, and Mr. Edwards, who bears the precious treaty?" "Certainly he did, and would be delighted to drink coffee in his own vessel with Dr. Maturin and the captain as soon as his lieutenants had done their business. This consisted of taking 125 silver dollars in 3 baskets of bird's nests by way of toll. And since Li Po had been telling out the coins with a morose deliberation ever since that well-known proa had been seen, picking the lightest and most dubious in his store, the transaction didn't take long. Yet even in that short time, Stephen had heard enough of Wanda's description of the French frigate Cornélie now ready for sea in Poulaprabang, and her frantic attempts at obtaining a minimum of stores for the voyage, to refuse the invitation on Jack's behalf. "Listen, brother," he said in an aside, "we are asked to cross to the other ship, but it will only mean you're listening to an immense amount of talk or making it longer still by translation. I'll tell you the gist when I come back. And to go across alone." "Yes," said Wanda, leading Stephen to a range of cushions. "She herself is ready for sea. She lies in the fairway, and all the most experienced navigators have advised them, given the season of the year, to sail by the Sawe Babu passage. So they will, they swear, if only they can rein supplies enough to take them there. And indeed they are doing fairly well. They have no money or credit, of course, but they have traded 6 9-pounders with a quantity of round shot and grape, 27 muskets, 2 cables, 1 bower anchor and a kedge for food, mostly sago. How sick of sago they will become long before the Sahibabu passage. Do you really believe that an armed and desperate ship will confine itself to sago, Wanda? Not if it can possibly meet a weaker ship in some far corner of the sea. A tiger must be served. But then, as I was telling you aboard the junk, there is the question of powder. Their gunner was a careless man, and even when they first came, many barrels had been spoiled. Then there was the immeasurable rain in the typhoon, your typhoon. It really grieved my heart to hear your news, said Wanda, laying his hand on Stephen's knee, and all they had ashore was flooded. Now the French envoy, the captain, and all the officers have given up their rings, their watches and ornaments, what table silver they have, their silver fittings, shoe buckles, rocks and hinges, to make up a sum to buy as many barrels, or even half barrels, as the Sultan will let them have. It is, of course, a royal monopoly. Oh, yes. Except for the Chinese and their fireworks. What quantities the French may privately have had from them, I cannot tell. Not much, I should think, on that little of no great force. What is the Sultan's view? He is indifferent. Now that Hafsa is so great with child, she has brought him a new concubine from Bali. An enchanting long-legged creature like a boy, said to be remarkably perverse. Wanda reflected for some moments with an inward smile and went on, he's quite besotted and he leaves everything to the vizier. Stephen knew Wanda intimately. They'd hunted together and Wanda had acted as the intermediary in Stephen's purchasing the council's goodwill by means of drafts on Shao Yen. After some thought, he brought out yet another of these papers with the Chinese banker's well-known red seal and said, Wanda, pray do me the very great kindness of seeing whether this will persuade the vizier to set his face against powder for the French. Point out to him that they may use it to bombard Prabang in revenge for having been given no treaty. They might confiscate the English subsidy, strip the royal treasury, violate the concubines. You owe the French nothing. You've protected them according to your word. What happens to them far away in the remote Salibabu passage, for example, is no concern of yours. In any event, as you know very well, whatever is to happen has already been decided. What is written is written. Very true, said Wanda. What is written is certainly written. It would be folly to deny it. But he didn't seem wholly decided or convinced. And when he turned to the coffee pot once more, he did so with a constrained, embarrassed smile. Do you remember Mr. Fox's rifled gun, the one he called the Manton? Asked Stephen after another cup or so, and some words about the honey bear. Wanda's expression changed to one of the most pleasurable recollection, retrospective joy, appreciation. The one with the swan's head on the rock. Stephen nodded and said, it is now mine. Would you do me the honour of accepting it as a keepsake? I'll give it to your boat's crew when they take me back. For now, dear Wanda, I am obliged to leave you. Your Excellency, said a secretary. One of the big local junks has come in, loaded to the gunwales with distressed British seamen. From one of the company's ships? Oh, no, sir, they're mostly white, or whitish, as far as one can see through the dirt. Jackson looked at them through his telescope, and he thought they belonged to the Mauritius privateer that put in last month. Well, damn them all, Do the necessary, Mr. Warner. The cavalry barracks is reasonably healthy, and you can indent upon Major Bentinck. The governor returned to his orchid, an epiphyte poised high on a stand so that its spray of about 50 white flowers, white of a singular purity with golden centres, hung down to his drawing-board, almost touching the particular clock by which he timed his moments of leisure. He was too deeply concerned with exact structure to be a fast worker, and he had only added 19, before the secretary returned and said, "I do beg your pardon, Excellency, but there's a fellow from the junk who insists on seeing you. Has papers he will give only into your hands. He says he's a medical man, but he has no wig and he hasn't shaved for a week." "Is his name Maturin?" "I'm ashamed to say I didn't catch it, sir. He was in quite a passion by the time I reached the hall. A small, slight, pale, ill-looking man. Desire him to walk in and cancel my engagements with the Dato Selim and Mr. Pearson." He put his drawing-board, watercolours and orchid carefully to one side and pressed the well-worn knob on his clock. As the door opened, he hurried forward, crying, "My dear Maturin, how very happy I am to see you. We've given you up for lost. I trust you're well." "Perfectly well, I thank you, Governor. Only a little ruffled," said Stephen, whose face was, indeed, somewhat less sallow than usual. "The sergeant offered me fourpence to go away. So sorry. Almost all the people have been changed. But do please sit down, drink some orangeado. Here's a nice cold jug, and tell me what's happened all this time." Fox successfully negotiated his treaty. The Diane then sailed to keep a rendezvous off the false Natunas. The other ship did not appear, and at the end of the stipulated time, Aubrey steered for Batavia. In the night, the frigate struck on an uncharted reef at the height of a spring tide. The sea was reasonably placid, the stranding far from disastrous, in no way a wreck. But it proved impossible to get her off in spite of the most extreme exertions, and we had to resign ourselves to waiting for the next very high water at the change of the moon. Mr. Fox thought it his duty to lose no time, and he sailed for Batavia together with his suite in the stoutest of the ship's boats carrying the treaty. He was overtaken by the typhoon that destroyed the Diane on her reef, and I fear he must necessarily have been lost. You've had no word?"
"No word at all."
"Nor could there be any word, I'm afraid. That typhoon was horribly destructive. Two Injurmen were dismasted and many, many country ships foundered. There was no conceivable hope for an open boat." After a pause, Maturin said, "He left an authenticated duplicate with his secretary, Mr. Edwards, as a formal precaution. I have it here," holding up a folder. "It was, of course, Edwards's office and privilege to bring it to you, but the poor young man is prostrated with dysentery, and he begged me to take it with his duty and respectful compliments in order that no time should be lost."
"Very proper in him."
Raffles took the envelope from the folder. "You'll forgive me?"
"Of course."
"No envoy ever obtained better terms," said Raffles at last. "They might have been dictated by the ministry." His satisfaction was not quite wholehearted, however, and having looked questioningly at Stephen, he went on, "But there's an accompanying letter."
"There is, I'm afraid,"
said Stephen. "I read it to see whether my part in the transaction was given away, revealed, I'll not say betrayed. A certain strangeness has led me to suppose that this might possibly be the case." "That at least he didn't do," said Raffles. "But it is a shockingly discreditable piece of invective. Poor Fox. I've seen this coming for some years, but to such a degree. You may not think so, Maturin, but as a young man he was excellent company. Terribly discreditable." He said again, looking at the neat, deliberate writing with distress. "So discreditable that I was tempted to suppress it. Does Mr. Edwards know the contents of the letter?"
"He does not, poor young man. Indeed, he builds all his hopes on delivering the treaty and whatever goes with it in Whitehall."
I see. You can absolutely assert that, Maturin. I can, too. It would blast Fox's reputation if it were made public. All his friends would regret it extremely. Olivia, my dear, he cried as his wife passed the French window wearing gardening gloves. Here's Dr. Maturin back from his travels and most of his companions with him. I beg your pardon, most humbly, ma'am, for appearing in this state in pantaloons and powdered hair and what might almost be taken for a beard, said Stephen. Captain Aubrey declared that I shouldn't go, that I should bring disgrace on the service, but I evaded him. He himself will not set foot on shore, nor will any of his men, until they are fit for an admiral's inspection. For you are to understand, ma'am, that we travelled in an unwashed junk, ordinarily employed in carrying ore, a potent source of filth, and our garments were stowed in a bewildering multiplicity of compartments. So it'll be an hour or so before he can do himself the honour of waiting on you. In the meantime, however, he desires his best compliments. Mrs. Raffles smiled, said that she was very happy to see Dr. Maturin again, that she would at once send to ask Captain Aubrey and his officers to dine that afternoon, and that she would now leave them. Now, said Raffles, as the men sat down again, do you choose to tell me how the treaty was obtained? There were, of course, many factors. The subsidy, Fox's arguments, and so on. But one was the fact that your banker and that dear man Van Buren brought me acquainted with the proper intermediaries, and I was able to conciliate the goodwill of a majority in the council. I hope you don't suppose that government will ever refund more than a tenth part of your expenditure, and that only after 7 years of impertinent, repetitious questioning. I do not. 'Twas an indulgence I allowed myself, mostly for the good cause, but also, I must admit, for a restless desire to undermine Ledward and his friend. Oh? What happened to them? It appears that having lost all credit at court, they were killed in an affray. I beg pardon. And since the French had virtually no money at all, Ledward having gambled it away, there was no competition, so the indulgence was not a costly one. I mean to offer myself another. The purchase of a tolerable merchantman approved for swift sailing. So you don't intend to go home in an Ingerman? Never in life. Did I not tell you of our rendezvous with another vessel in these waters, or farther afield, and our return by way of New South Wales? Yes, you did, but I'd imagine the time was past. Not at all. Several possibilities were foreseen. Besides, in your private ear, it is not inconceivable that we may meet the Cornelia. Wouldn't that call for a very considerable ship, a very considerable outlay? Very considerable indeed, no doubt, but then I have a not inconsiderable surplus in Shao Yen's hands. My gifts were pitifully small, and if that's not enough, I could always draw on London. A pause. An unnatural pause. You look down, sir. You have, if I may so express myself, an uneasy, embarrassed air. Why, to tell you the truth, Maturin, I must confess that I feel both uneasy and embarrassed. There's no personal mail for you or Aubrey. I presume it's gone to New South Wales. But I have what may be very wretched news for you. Did you not tell me that you changed your unsatisfactory bank? So I did, too. As sullen, unobliging a set of illiterate dogs as ever you could wish to see. And that in their place you'd chosen Smith and Close? Just so. Then, with very much regret, I'm obliged to tell you that Smith and Close have suspended payment. They're broke. There may eventually be some small dividend for the creditors, but at present there's not the least possibility of your drawing on them. Stephen had an instant, brilliantly clear vision of the attorney's office in Portsmouth in which the document requiring his bank to transfer all he possessed to Smith and Close was written.
together with a power of attorney addressed to Sir Joseph Blaine, who was also the executor of his will. A document framed by an able lawyer, a man of business thoroughly accustomed to dealing with shifts, evasions, and bad faith, an aged, dusty man who took real pleasure in his task, his toothless jaws munching as his pen scratched on and on. The dusty room was lined with books for reference rather than delight, and the dusty window looked out onto a blank wall. A reflector hanging at an angle sent a certain hint of day to the dim ceiling, and the reflection of a passing gull moved across as a darker shadow among the cobwebs.
"There, sir," said the lawyer, "if you'll copy that, for in such matters holograph is always best. I defy the most contentious cavilling prig in the kingdom to get round it. You'll not forget to sign both documents and send them off to Sir Joseph by the evening post. The bag is not sealed until 5:30, which gives you plenty of time to copy 2 sheets wrote small and to go aboard before the turn of the tide."
The recollection, and even the attorney's creaking little speech, could scarcely have taken a heartbeat of time, for here was Raffles' voice going on almost without the loss of a word. "But, on the other hand, I do have some less dismal tidings, I'm happy to say, some trifling set off. We have recently weighed a Dutch 20-gun ship. She'd been sunk on purpose several months ago because of infection, and now she is as trim and tight as the day she was launched. If we were on the terrace, you could see her with a glass. She lies just inside the island by the Dutch company's yard. As I say, she's only a 20-gun ship, so you can hardly set about the Cornelie, but at least she may enable you to keep your appointment."
"You astonish me, Governor. I'm amazed, happily amazed," said Stephen.
"I'm glad of that," said Raffles, looking at him doubtfully. "May I go and tell Aubrey of our good fortune? I left him in a sombre mood, conning over the innumerable ship's books and papers belonging to the late Diane that he must present to the senior naval officer here. He is sadly puzzled, because when the Dyaks attacked our island, he lost both his purser and his clerk."
"Lord Maturin," cried Raffles, "you never told me about that."
"I'm a very poor reporter of battles. I don't see them, nor in general do I take part. In this one I was in the hospital tent almost all the time. I didn't even join the final charge. It was a severe engagement. They killed and wounded many of our people. We destroyed them entirely. But Captain Aubrey will give you an exact account. He leapt about the field of blood as though it were his native heath. You know a tiger's coughing roar, of course.
Of course.
That is the noise he makes when in battle. Will I go and fetch him now and shift my clothes into something more worthy of dear Mrs. Raffles' table?"
"Certainly. My barge will carry you over at once and bring our guests back. Pray, how many officers survived?"
"All, but the purser, the clerk, and one midshipman, though Fielding will limp the days of his life, and Bennett, the master's mate, is still in a very precarious state, while little Reed lost an arm."
"That little curly-headed boy?"
"No. The little curly-headed boy was killed." Raffles shook his head. But there was no decent comment, and he only said, "I'll send for the barge." Having done so, he said, "As for Aubrey, ships, books, and senior naval officer, there's none here, none nearer than Colombo. That's why I have such a free hand with this Dutch ship. I may observe that I've known cases where all a ship's books and papers were lost in a wreck or by enemy action, and the authorities remained totally unmoved, giving a quietus out of hand, whereas a missing docket or receipt or signature in one of the many, many volumes has meant interminable wrangling correspondence and accounts unsettled for 7 years, or even 10. I throw this out quite unofficially, of course." On his way down to the water's edge, Stephen asked the governor's coxswain to lead him to a toy shop. "I wish to buy dolls suitable for 3 little Chinese girls, he said. For it had been arranged that he and Jack should stay at the residence, and as Li Po was urgent to sail for his cargo of ore on the next tide, this was probably the last time he'd see them.
"Dolls, sir?"
said the coxswain in a wondering voice.
And he considered for some time before going on, "I don't know any but a Dutch shop. And what a Chinese girl would make of a Dutch doll, I cannot tell. You know best, sir, in view of the parties concerned." "In view of the parties concerned," he repeated with some satisfaction. He led Stephen to a shop by a canal, a shop with two bow windows on either side of an open door in which there sat a fat Batavian sloven. "The gentleman wants to buy a doll," said the coxswain. "Doll," he said much louder, jerking his arm and head in a wooden manner. The sloven looked at them with pale, narrowed, suspicious eyes, but at length recognising the governor's livery, she heaved herself up and let them into the shop. The choice was limited to half a dozen figures showing the clothes fashionable in Paris several years ago. She turned up their skirts and petticoats to show their frilly and, above all, removable drawers.
"Real lace, yes, yes," she said.
Having gazed at them for some minutes, Stephen, in despair, picked the three less offensive images. The sloven wrote the price on a card, large and plain, and gave it to the coxswain, repeating, "Real lace, yes, yes." "She says half a joe apiece, sir," said the coxswain, deeply shocked, for half a joe was close on £2. Stephen laid down the money, and with a leering smile, the sloven added three complimentary chamber pots to the parcel. "Well, I don't know, I'm sure," said the coxswain. "I never seen a Chinese girl with anything like this. No, yet a little more." As the governor's barge pulled out to the junk, Stephen reflected on his new poverty, but superficially. He didn't inquire into the nature of his feelings, or rather of the feeling that was taking shape at some depth. For the present, he was scarcely aware of anything but a general sense of loss and a certain dismay. Often in battle he'd had men brought to him shockingly hurt, but hardly conscious of it, particularly if the wound couldn't be seen. "I shall dismiss it for a week or so," he said. He'd done this with various misfortunes, losses and infidelities in the past, and although dreams sometimes undid him by night, and although there were other disadvantages, it still seemed to him the best way of dealing with a situation where distress and emotion were likely to get out of hand. Relative importance often proved less than he had supposed in the first confusion of mind. Aboard the junk he called Mai Mai, Lu Meng and Pen Cao, and gave them his presents. They thanked him politely, bowed again and again, and cherished the carefully folded wrapping paper. But it was clear from their wondering look at the figures and their shocked, even indignant, recognition of the garnished chamber pots that Stephen hadn't given the pleasure he'd hoped for. Though with a certain lack of confidence, it's true. He had better luck in the den he shared with Jack Aubrey. Making his way through the labyrinthine bowels of the big junk and along its broad, short decks, he saw that Mrs. Raffles' invitation had been received. Elegant, broadcloth coats calculated to resist an Arctic gale were hanging brushed and trim in shady places, and their owners, wearing white breeches, stood close to them, keeping as cool and dust-free as possible. "There you are, Stephen," cried Jack, an involuntary smile ruining the severity of his tone. "And much credit have you spread on the service, no doubt. I wonder the dogs didn't set upon you. Ahmed and Killick took your clothes in hand the moment the invitation came, and there they are laid out on the chest. I'll pass the word for the ship's barber." "Before he comes," said Stephen, "let me tell you two things or three. The first is that Raffles has a ship for you. A Dutch 20-gun ship that was wholly immersed for some months on purpose and that has now been raised." "Oh, oh," cried Jack, his face lighting with joy. That is to say, glowed bright red, his teeth gleaming in the redness and his eyes a brighter blue, and he shook Stephen's hand with paralysing force. "The second is that when we met Wan Da, he told me, as you know, that the Cornélie would be sailing soon. What I did not tell you was that she will be following much the same course that we should have taken in the Diane and must take in this dredged-up Dutchman by the more or less obligatory Salibabu passage, that she was extremely short of powder, and that as it is a state monopoly, I asked him to persuade the vizier to allow her none. The plum-coloured happiness disappeared from Jack's face. He looked down. At that time, went on Stephen, I had our possible merchantman in mind, and I didn't choose to have her captured or blown out of the water if I could avoid it. In any case, the Cornelie probably has some powder salved or purchased from the Chinese merchants, and of course I cannot tell how successful Wanda may have been. He thought it better not to say anything about the ship's books at present. There was something of a pause, and in that pause began the drumming of the monsoon rain, louder and louder. "Well," said Jack, something of the first glow returning, "I cannot tell you how delighted I am about the governor's ship," raising his voice. "Killick! Killick there! Pass the word for the barber." "Gentlemen," said the governor, "I cannot tell you how delighted we are, Mrs. Raffles and I, to see you at this table. We would indeed wish there were more of you, and that you were all whole, though, to be sure," bowing to his bandaged guests and smiling particularly at Reed, who blushed and looked at his plate, "there are many glorious precedents." It was a well-turned, sincere speech of welcome, delivered with that felicity which had often carried the day in committees, but it didn't quite hit the naval tone, and Raffles' hearers, ordinarily fed much earlier in the day, were hungry, clammily hot and thirsty, in spite of the rain that had pierced their boat cloaks, that any speech would have been too long for them. They displayed no sullenness, but no very eager attention either, and when Reed turned pale, the governor came to an abrupt close, skipping five paragraphs, and drinking to their happy return in ice-cold claret cup, considered more healthy in this climate for invalids and the young. Dish after dish, and cheerfulness returned, helped by Mrs. Raffles' natural kindness, natural gifts as a hostess, and by the cool breeze that followed the rain. It was wonderful to see how much the invalids and the young contrived to eat, and how pleasantly they were persuaded to take an informal leave as soon as any lassitude appeared. It was a diminished company that reached the port, a still smaller one that joined Mrs. Raffles and the two other ladies for coffee and tea, and only Jack, Stephen and Fielding survived to walk into the library with the governor. Jack had already made his acknowledgements, his most heartfelt acknowledgments for Raffles' kindness in offering him the Dutch ship, the Gelegenheit. And now the governor gave him a portfolio of her plans, sheer draft, deck draft, profile, and everything else capable of exact measurement and representation, and over these the sailors pored with close professional attention, while Ahmed brought the surviving botanical specimens from the voyage. Before opening the packet, Stephen gave Raffles a succinct account of Kumai, that other Eden, its orangutans, its tarsiers, its tree shrews. "If I could foresee a fortnight's peace, I should go there tomorrow," said Raffles. "A visit of courtesy to the Sultan confirming the alliance would be a perfect excuse, and the sloop Plover due from Colombo at the end of the month would give me pomp enough. But you can have no idea of how uneasy rests ahead with even a hemi-demi-semi crown upon it. Java and its dependencies have a vast population of rajas and sultans and great feudatories, and they're all given to parricide, fratricide and coup d'etat. And then there's the enmity between the Javanese, Madjaris, ordinary Malays, of course, Kalangs, Baduis, Amboynese, Bugis, Hindus, Armenians and the rest. They all hate one another, but they're all ready to combine against the Chinese, and quite a small riot can spread with extraordinary speed." He looked attentively at the package. "Should you like a knife?" he asked. "I believe I can manage the knot," said Stephen, seizing it with his canine teeth. Sailors do so hate to see one cut cords, ropes, or even string," he added in a muffled voice. "There, I have it. Now, this first packet is a more or less promiscuous collection of what was growing in the boreen behind Van Buren's house. I make no doubt that most are familiar to you."
"By no means all," said Raffles.
And as he sorted them into two heaps, he observed, "There's a man coming this evening who knows a great deal about these epiphytic plants. Jacob Sowerby. He's published in the Transactions, and he's been recommended to me for the post of government naturalist. So I've seen one or two others, but now this," holding up a limp object that could have appealed only to a devoted botanist, "is something I've never seen, nor anything remotely like it."
"Your Excellency," said the secretary, "Major Bushell sends to beg you to come to the Chinese market. Your presence would deal with the trouble at once. Captain West has already turned out the guard in case you see fit to go, and Mr. Sowerby's here."
"I'm so sorry," said the governor to Stephen and to the secretary. "Very well, Mr. Akers, I shall go by the Lion Court. Pray make my excuses to Mr. Sowerby. I hope to be back in half an hour. You may as well show him up," he called back from the farther door. Mr. Sowerby walked in. A tall, thin man of perhaps 40. From his tense expression, it was clear that he was nervous, and from his first words, it was clear that his uneasiness had made him aggressive. Stephen bowed and said, "Mr. Sowerby, I believe. My name is Maturin." "You're a botanist, I suppose," said Sowerby, glancing at the specimens.
"I should scarcely call myself a botanist," said Stephen, "though I did publish a little work on the phanerogams of Upper Ossory."
"A naturalist, then?" "I think I might fairly describe myself as a naturalist," said Stephen. Sowerby made no reply for some time, but sat there biting his nails. It was clear to Stephen that the man regarded him as a rival, but his manner was so disobliging that Stephen didn't undeceive him. Eventually Sowerby, looking at his bitten nails, said, "A very small book would deal with the phanerogams of Ossory. Ossory's in Ireland. And no great work would be required to deal with the whole country, except perhaps for the very low forms of life in the bogs. I've been there, and although I'd been told of its poverty, I was astonished to find how very poor it was, in fact, flora, fauna, and populace."
"Oh, come, that's not every island that can boast the arbutus and the phalarope."
"It's not every island that can boast the Iceland moss, or such hordes of barefoot savage children in the capital city itself. Extreme poverty."
Although the poverty of which Sowerby was speaking in the present instance referred to birds, no woodpeckers, no shrikes, no nightingale, the word suddenly brought Stephen's realization of Smith and Close bankruptcy to life, and this added a fresh dimension to his already complex feelings. He was determined not to show how Sowerby's reflections wounded and angered him, but it was difficult to support the comparison of Trinity College in Dublin and its pinched brick lodgings for the students with the splendid courts of my own Trinity at Cambridge, itself but part of a far greater university. But the entire difference between the two islands is on the same scale. And almost impossible to listen with any appearance of equanimity to the long tirade about the disgraceful events of 1798, when a numerous band of traitors rose against their natural sovereign, burnt my uncle's rectory, and stole three of his cows. Or the statement that this poverty and this ignorance had always been and would always be the lot of that unfortunate, priest-ridden community as long as they persisted in the Romish superstition.
"Oh, Governor," said Stephen, turning as the far door opened and Raffles came in with a mission accomplished look on his face. "I'm so glad you're come just at this moment to hear me crush my, I will not say opponent, but rather interlocutor, with a singularly apt quotation that has just floated into my mind. Mr. Sowerby here maintains that the Irish have always been poor and ignorant. I maintain that this has not always been the case, and I support my statement not out of any annals such as those of the Four Masters, which might be looked upon as biased, but out of a purely English authority, that of your own Venerable Bede himself, God be with him. In the year 664, he says in his ecclesiastical history, a sudden pestilence, which in Irish we call the Bula Conai, the Yellow Plague, depopulated the southern coasts of England, and soon afterwards, extending into the province of the Northumbrians, destroyed a great multitude of men. It did no less harm in the island of Ireland, where many of the nobility and of the lower ranks of the English nation, he coughed and went on, where many of the nobility and of the lower ranks of the English nation were at the time studying theology or leading monastic lives, the Irishmen supplying them with food and furnishing them with books and their teaching gratis pro deo. Jack had been watching him closely and with great anxiety. He knew that Stephen was furiously angry, and he knew what Stephen was capable of. Now, as his friend sat down, his hands no longer trembling, Jack cried, "Well quoted, Doctor! Well quoted, upon my honour! I couldn't have done half so well without it had been the Articles of War." "It was indeed a knockdown blow, my dear matron," said Raffles. "One of those replies one usually makes the day after the event. What have you to say, Mr. Sowerby?" Mr. Sowerby had only to say that he meant no national reflection, was unaware that the gentleman came from Ireland, begged his pardon for any involuntary offence, and took advantage of the sailor's departure to make his bow. "I hope all went well," said Stephen. "Oh, yes," cried Raffles. "It's almost the end of Ramadan, you know, and the stricter Muslims grow fractious by the end of the day, particularly such a burning day as this. Tomorrow they'll be their usual amiable selves, greasy with mutton fat. But I'm sorry you had to endure that fellow. Must have seemed very long." "The gentleman's second name is Prolixity," said Stephen. They sorted their orchids in silence for a while, and then, in a hesitant voice, Raffles said, "You are no doubt usually surrounded with gentlemen and fellow officers, people who know your origin and your worth. I wonder whether you're aware how widespread these illiberal opinions are. Poverty, illiteracy, popery, and so on. And the very strong dislike of those in any way connected with the rising. If you've not mixed with the kind of people who are in authority in New South Wales, I'm afraid you may be deeply shocked should you stay any length of time." "I did have a passing glimpse of them in the time of that unfortunate man, William Bligh. We touched at Sydney Cove for some essential stores and the Leopard. The people were in a state of insurrection, but from what little I saw of the officers, they seemed to me, with some exceptions, a parcel of beggars on horseback, with all the froward arrogance and vanity the term implies. Alas, there's been no improvement since then." "It is an odd thing," said Stephen after a pause, "that when the American colonists broke away from England, a great many English supported them. Even James Boswell did so, to my astonishment, in opposition to Dr. Johnson. Yet when the Irish tried to do the same, no voice, as far as I know, was heard in their favour. It is true that Johnson, speaking of the infamous union with Kevin Fitzgerald, said, 'Do not make an union with us, sir. We should unite with you only to rob you.' But that was long before the rising. It's a standing wonder to me that Johnson should have borne with that scrub Boswell, and that the scrub should have written such a capital book. I remember a passage where the doctor grew outrageous about the revolting colonials and called them a race of convicts that ought to be thankful for anything we allow them short of hanging. And another where he said, "I'm willing to love all mankind except an American." And called them rascals, robbers, pirates, exclaiming he'd burn and destroy them. But then the intrepid Miss Seward said, "Sir, this is an instance that we are always the most violent against those whom we have injured. Perhaps the same violence is now in action against the Irish. Will you join me in a bowl of punch?" "I believe not, Raffles, though I'm very sensible of your kindness. Indeed, as soon as we've sorted through this heap, I shall bid you good night. It's been a somewhat wearing day." As he passed through the corridor where the secretaries lived, he caught the heavy scent of opium, a drug he'd used for many years in the more convenient form of laudanum, taking it sometimes for pleasure and relaxation, sometimes for the relief of pain, but above all for dealing with emotional distress. He'd abandoned it on his reconciliation with Diana, doing so for many reasons, one of them being his belief that a man ought to manage without bottled fortitude. Plain fortitude from within, that was the cry. But as he caught that familiar smell, it occurred to him that he might well have been tempted to break his resolution if he'd happened to have a pint bottle at hand. Tonight was going to call for an uncommon constancy of mind. For one thing, he'd been exceedingly angry, which was no help to sleep at all. For another, it was likely that his more loquacious self, in spite of all the discipline he could impose upon it, would, in moments of distraction or near sleep, certainly torment him with observations on his new poverty, his inability to oblige Diana to endow a chair of osteology, to do the handsome thing on occasion, to maintain some of the annuities he'd promised, to undertake remote voyages in the surprise when peace should come at last. And if he slept at all, the waking would be worse with all these aspects invading his mind afresh, accompanied, no doubt, by others he'd not yet perceived. The event proved him totally wrong in both instances. Sleep came at once, jumbling the last words of his paternoster. A deep sleep, in which he lay totally relaxed until, in the first hint of light, he became aware of the luxury of lying there in a state of almost disembodied ease and well-being. Then of the delighted recollection that they had a ship, and then of a massive form between him and the faint source of light, and of Jack's rumbling whisper asking him if he were awake. "What if I am, brother?" he replied. "Why, then," said Jack, his deep voice filling the room as usual, "Bondon has, as it were, found a little green skiff, and I thought you might like to come with me and look at the raised Dutch sloop whose name I never can recall." "By all means," said Stephen, getting out of bed and flinging on his clothes. "Of course, I suppose you could wash and shave later," said Jack. "We are to breakfast with the governor, you recall." "Aye, well, I dare say we are, but a wig covers a multitude of sins." At this time, the citadel of Batavia, which contained the governor's residence, was in a somewhat chaotic state, the last Dutch administration having tried to deal with the appalling mortality from fever by doing away with many of the moats, canals, and water defences, and by temporarily diverting others, with the result that Stephen had but to step from his window into the green skiff, and with Bondon's helping hand to settle himself on a borrowed cushion in the stern where Jack joined him. They pulled gently along this narrow, winding domestic waterway for 100 yards or so, once looking straight into an astonished kitchen, once into a room from which they averted their blushing faces, then out through the ruined water gate, along the canal through the shallows, running gently with the tide, and so into the open bay. The growing day was perfectly calm, and the few large fishing proas that were in motion paddled through the mist, singing gently. Stephen went to sleep again. When he woke, Bondon was still pulling with the same steady rhythm, but the sun rising behind them had burnt off all the hazy vapours. The smooth sea was a most delicate, united blue, and Jack Aubrey was staring right ahead through the brilliance with extreme concentration. There she lays,
he observed, noticing Stephen's movement. And Stephen, following his gaze, saw an island with a wharf. And alongside the wharf, the hull or body of a dull brown ship, rather small. "Oh!" he cried before his wits were quite returned. "It has no masts." "What sweet, sweet lines," said Jack. And in a parenthesis to Stephen, "she'll be towed to the sheer hulk in a day, or mast in God's plenty. Did you ever see sweeter bonden?" "Never, sir. Barring surprise, of course." "The boat, ahoy!" came the hail. "Diane," replied Bonden in a voice of brass. The acting deputy assistant master attendant received the captain of the Diane with what formality his working party of four would allow, but the ceremony was wrecked by a vehement and indeed shrewish yell from below. "John, if you don't come this directly minute, your eggs will be hard and your bacon all burnt." "Pray go along and take your breakfast, sir," said Jack. "I can find my way about perfectly well. His Excellency gave me her plans last night." She was, in fact, perfectly familiar from his last night's studies. Yet, as he led Stephen up and down the ladders, along the decks and into the holds, he kept exclaiming, "Oh, what a sweet little ship, what a sweet little ship!" And when they were on the forecastle again, looking back towards Batavia, he said, "Never mind the paintwork, Stephen, never mind the masts. A few weeks' work in the yard will provide all that, but only a brilliant hand with noble wood at his command, you saw those perfect hanging knees, could produce such a little masterpiece as this." He considered for a while, smiling, and then said, "Tell me, what was the title poor fox tripped over during our first audience of the Sultan? Kesegaran Mawa Bunga Budi Bahasa Hiburan Buapala. I dare say, but it was your translation of it that I meant. What was the last piece?" "Nutmeg of Consolation." "That's it. Those were the very words hanging there in the back of my mind. Oh, what a glorious name for a tight, sweet, newly coppered, broad buttock little ship. A solace to any man's heart. The nutmeg for daily use, of consolation for official papers. Dear nutmeg, what joy!"